like to welcome a very special guest tonight, a very early and prolific contributor to the Doomer Optimism podcast and the larger ecosystem, Trace Crow.
Thanks for having me, Simon. Good to talk to you again. It's always fun to have a second round of podcast coverage with the same people. So
sure, of course. Yeah, definitely enjoyed our previous sessions too. So today we're going to talk about a few different things, but basically Trace and I have been talking a lot lately about collaboration and digital regeneration and agroecology projects and making a difference within our own sphere. Not the rural spaces, not the always urban spaces, but what can we do in the suburbs and exurbs where we both live and have potential to influence things there. And we both feel like there's a whole lot of untapped potential in the existing infrastructure and general design of suburbs as they are now. And this is going to be the first episode of hopefully a series covering this topic with varying guests over the next couple of weeks here. And we just feel there's a powerful opportunity to make change at a manageable scale in many of these existing communities, and we're excited about the possibilities.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That's a great introduction there, Simon, about some of the topics we've been talking about. I mean, I think, you know, it is sort of an open question, right? Like, what are we going to do about the suburbs? Because we have put so many resources, like the majority of our sunk cost is in the suburbs, at least in this country. And I believe it's similar up in Canada, right?
Absolutely.
And so what are we going to do with that? Like, can we abandon them? And if we do abandon them, what does that mean? Do we move further afield and just wash into the country, right? That doesn't seem sustainable or beneficial. Or do we contract into these mega cities where everyone's kind of living on top of each other? Certainly, it seems to a sizable segment of the DO sphere that would not be a particularly great way to live. Mm-hmm. So it kind of feels like we're left with this, like we have to do something with the suburbs. We just can't abandon them. Which means, what do we do with these spaces that are arguably the least human spaces we have in the country? You know, they're really devoted to cars and mechanized equipment. They're maintained with mechanized equipment. Everything about it is machine powered, which means what? Fossil fuel powered, right? So what are we going to do about it? That's sort of an open question. I think that's really what we're hoping to solve this tonight, right?
Right.
What to do with the suburbs? When you think of the suburbs, what do you think is the most egregious part of it? Like, what is the thing that seems the most impossible to reform? You know,
probably shaking out of the current mindset. So much of Canada's economy, for instance, has been real estate for the past while. So they're empowering developers to basically grow at all costs. So like the sprawl, you always hear about urban sprawl, but the fact that there's been no policy around any sort of sustainable growth within these suburbs. And then you see the immediate issues that come with that. So they expand onto the hillsides. Now people are complaining about wildlife walking through the yards. The bears get killed. The cougars start snatching cats. They get killed. You know, there's deer eating everybody's gardens. Or you see fires coming closer. People can't get insurance anymore in lots of places because you've seen that the growth at all costs without factoring in any of the environment around that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's really astounding to think like the level of investment, right? Like if you think historically, humans have been around for, you know, or some sort of human-like creature has been around for millions of years, right? But we were like given this, you know, 100 million a year one-time gift of like free energy, or what seemed like free energy. And not only did we burn through it in like only like 300 years, or we're burning through a lot of it in 300 years, it keeps escalating. And we built an entire global economy on this assumption of continued growth and continued ability to expand, when really in the last 20 years, for sure. But I would say even back to Rachel Carson in the 60s, It was becoming very clear that like that we are bumping up against like actual real boundaries, right?
Right.
That there is no more.
Absolutely.
There's no more. There's nowhere else to go, right? And you are starting to see it in these kind of megalopolises, right? Where you have this just sprawl going everywhere. And it's sort of like third, fourth generation sprawl. So it's even more mindless in a way, because
it is.
It's just taking all these precepts, right? It's just sort of like, oh yes, building houses is good, right? We have to, you know, home ownership is good. Everyone has to own a home. Everyone has to own a certain type of home. Everyone has to have these certain, the right to have equal access to city services and public services, no matter how much money it cost,
right,
to get the services to them, right? That's a big part of like Strongtown's platform, is just the sheer financial insanity of the suburb.
Sure.
Right.
It's so true. Not to mention the cheapening of materials over the past 2 decades. Like houses have, they're no longer resilient. You're seeing houses that are put up in the last 20 years or they're dying before the house, any of the houses that were built in even the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Inappropriate building materials as well, like we saw with the heat waves in the West Coast in Canada here, people had with vinyl siding, even in the North, their siding was melting when it got over 40 C. But yeah, it's,
man, that's wild. I didn't hear about that. That's pretty wild.
Yeah.
I mean, it's across the board. I mean, I think that like the suburban sprawl, and especially as it's become like exurban sprawl, where it's not even really attached to a city anymore, it's attached to just region in a way, has really, I don't know, in the last 20 years, 30 years, it does feel like it's just become more mindless and like more like we're doing it for reasons that everyone's acting as though those reasons are settled. We don't even have to relitigate. We don't have to think about it. Just keep doing it this way.
Right.
It's kind of bumping up against a wall. But also, here's the interesting thing. Okay, so I'm obviously very like hard on the suburbs, but I do live here. And I mean it when I say, like, when I squint, I see something really beautiful. And I think that in a way it's sort of getting back to what suburbs were supposed to be, initially were conceived of, was as a country estate for people to retreat to, right? And many of those early suburbs, like the ones built outside of Chicago, and Brooklyn, for instance, started as a suburb of New York. And they were built as little villages, right? And they function still as little villages. And I kind of see that, you know, what's missing is there's no connection to nature. Cars are still running the streets. But if you add more nature and have more human-centered approach to transportation, it starts to feel like, oh, okay. Like this kind of feels like an older, slower America.
It could be a community almost. Yeah. Do you see much, like, I know we don't have the solutions, but we have some small ones that we can work on for sure within our own influence. But do you see, like, municipal regulation playing a big role in maximizing resilience and human flourishing in these spaces? Or do you think this should be more of a grassroots movement?
Well, I don't see them as necessarily, like, mutually exclusive. You know, I mean, there's plenty of historical evidence of, like, you know, sort of the tail wagging the dog, right? Where government puts something in place because it's the right thing to do, and then culture sort of fits in, right? Like, you know, drunk driving, for instance, right? Or cigarette smoking. Like, these are things that were like everywhere for a very long time. And then, you know, well, although both of those really started with grassroots stuff before the government got involved.
Sure.
So maybe I'm actually, maybe the neither of those are good examples. But yeah, I think especially at the local level, like you have to have some sort of like way of structuring relationships, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, very few people that I've encountered are really in favor of like no rules. Like,
right.
They may just want the Catholic Church to be the purveyor of the rules, or they want small D democratic, you know, city council, or there is some body that we want to put faith and put the onus of, you know, mutual aid and things mm-hmm. on. And we want to have some say in it, generally speaking.
Sure.
And so I think government plays a role. I get more and more suspicious the larger those governments are, because
of course.
At a certain point they have to, like, you know, a rounding error is 10,000 people, right? But that's 10,000 people's lives were badly affected by a decision that may have been good for
right. people, sure.
but was very bad for a large group of people, right?
Sure.
And so I think there needs to be a lot of self-determination at the lower levels, and less yeah. power, you know, accrued to the top.
Yeah. Which yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So I was just going to say, like, my thinking around that was, like, so much of the growth now and the cheapening of that lifestyle, like the suburban lifestyle, I would say is probably attributed to developers and large corporations coming in and buying tracts of land and developing this land. Without that oversight, or without the end user being considered, like the people that are going to live there, it's no longer people building their own homes in the suburbs. You know, it's developers buying massive chunks of land and developing as many houses as cheaply as they can and fitting in as many as they can. So I'm just wondering, like, the municipal regulation, maybe mandatory green space or even mandatory commercial space
mm-hmm.
per 100 homes or something, you know, to maintain that sort of accessibility and walkability within these communities.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the separation of the different uses, you know, it's funny because it seems like every time something's good, you know, like, it starts with good intentions and it always ends up being corrupted in some way, because you know, it was good. Like, we do not want a factory spewing, you know, chemicals into the air right next to people's homes. Like, that made a lot of sense, but it just took it to this where, like, no, you can't even have a Macy's near a home. And now people, you know, let alone a bodega or something that could be of use to people in that neighborhood. Like, it's absurdly separated.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I think that the problem is not regulation or not lack of regulation. It's too much regulation. I mean, they have all these separations and setbacks and all these rules that are practically the only way you can thread that needle is to produce exactly what the suburbs look like.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, you know, reducing regulations, I think, would have a much better effect. You know, and if you want to reform the regulations to, you know, kind of point people in the direction you want them to point them into. But I think people had that way anyway. Like, I think most people would be perfectly fine with a little cafe in their suburban neighborhood, right?
Absolutely.
Especially if, you know, it was one that closed at, you know, 5. Like, it was just there to service the local community. I think people would be overjoyed with that, generally speaking. But it's just because of the zoning, and also then the rules around rezoning things. Like, it's just having such a public airing that, like, it just leaves plenty of room for, you know, any idea getting shot down.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. That I'm thinking of, like, the parallels as well of the sort of overregulation, the things that they tried to stop, and then you also have urban sprawl happening, or suburban sprawl, and eventually you get back to a Walmart on one side of the highway and you know, housing developments on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So we're back to where we started, separated by a highway, so it doesn't count, but, like, it's the same outcome that they were trying to avoid.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And also, we, like, you know, a sort of like, obfuscating of the pollution, right? Like, it's very obvious to say, I don't want these homes near a coal plant spewing coal dust into the air, right? It's a lot different to then oppose, I mean, we all we did was just move that into the road, right? The road,
right.
I mean, it's micro dust, it's bits of glass and tire rubber and all sorts of stuff, rust, all these things are just flying around. And to be live near that is just not good for you.
Yeah. I mean,
a lot of particulates and things in the air. And so we just sort of like said, yeah, we don't want this coal plant here. How about we put it everywhere so that you can't avoid it? You know,
there you go.
And it's pretty astounding, but I think there's a lot of things that get that, you know, that's how they get explained away, or that's how they get, you know, sort of absorbed in the consciousness of a culture, is that like they just hide its origin, or the origins are hidden, or they
make there you go
multifarious, or it's just part of what we breathe, literally in this case.
That's interesting. And you see the same patterns quite often, especially around like where we once had Victory Gardens, or people producing so much of their own food on site, on their little homes, or around their little homes. And now it's become either factory farming or subsistence farming. Those are the only two ways you can do it, right? That's completely obfuscated now.
Yeah. And in the suburbs, you have an HOA, which is probably going to stop you from doing that, certainly in the front yard. Though the interesting thing is, I have been talking to a lot of HOAs recently, and I think that they're probably a convenient villain that is not as villain as they seem, because they're populated, like millennial homeowners as a whole are very open to other ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't have a lot of options. Certainly, you know, I mean, the nicest places to live in this country are all incredibly gentrified and difficult to break into. And millennials notoriously don't have a lot of money. So like those things are not available to them. So they're making these pockets where they are basically. And they're starting to be on HOAs, right? They're starting to people making these decisions, and they're really open to new opportunities, but there's just not a tremendous amount of guidance on how you go from one mode of being to another mode of being.
Sure.
You know, especially when you're saddled with a lot of debt, really, from previous generations, you know, with like crappier builds, right? Like, you start seeing these like condos that were built in the 80s, right? They're falling apart now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it'd be better to buy something from the 1920s than something from the 80s at this point. And once you get to the 90s or the 2000s, it's like, my gosh, they make it
toast.
A decade.
We'll sure.
Surprise. So they have all this debt that they're trying to take on, and you know, it makes it difficult to make wise decisions when you have all this kind of historical pressure, as well as not a lot of guidance on doing things better, like in a way that
So before this call, recently too, you were telling me about your project Greenbox. Can you tell me a bit about that now before I
so
wrap that back?
I mean, if anyone knows who I am, you know, I've been working with Roots Down for the last 3 years. I'm still very much involved in that company, but you know, Roots Down was trying to solve the problem of, you know, not what to do with the suburbs necessarily, what to do with landscape, because it's an absolute atrocious industry as far as the environmental, its labor record. Like, it's a really, really difficult industry to get into as an environmentalist, right? And so we were trying to solve that problem. In the process of trying to solve that problem, we realized that there's actually a ton of layers to the problem, right? Homeowners are part of the problem. Landscapers are part of the problem. Corporations, governments, it's layers and layers of problems that are just reinforcing each other. And so we realized there was opportunity for other types of businesses and other types of organizations to be more focused on individual parts of the problem. Roots Down is really going to be starting to focus a lot on corporate clients, like large property owners, governments, things like that, in order to try and change large batches of land at once, right? Sort of solve the problem at scale by going after the largest property owners. My personal like drive comes more from like working with homeowners or individual property owners or empowering kind of everyday people to try and solve these problems themselves. You know, if you own land, you own the ability to solve the problem. It, you know, a small piece of it, like you own a piece of the problem, right? Mm-hmm. And so one, you could say you have a responsibility to solve it. I think that seems a little too authoritarian, but like you certainly have an opportunity to be part of the solution.
And the means.
And the means, yes. And so I have a real passion for that audience. And so I split off this month, which for depending on when this you know, posts, it would be September, and started a company called Green Box Homes, which is really dedicated to what I say, like dedicated to empowering the first generation of regenerative homeowners. So there's a lot of solutions out: composting, glass recycling, plastic recycling, sustainable landscaping. There's a lot of things going on, and there's not really like a unified place for it all. And I kind of have an ambition to create that. I'm starting with landscaping because that's what I know. So my real interest with landscaping is trying to combine the services that individual homeowners or HOAs would need in order to make the transition. And so in kind of isolating the problem, it seems like they really need a little bit of design, a little bit of install, a little bit of maintenance, a little bit of education. They kind of need all of it at once, but they can't afford to hire a landscape architect, a installation company. You know, they can't, that's an insane prospect. That's hundreds of thousands of dollars in investment, right? Not for an individual homeowner. I'm thinking more for an HOA. So So the purpose of Greenbox is to take those four services and just kind of package them up as a monthly, like affordable monthly service that they can hire and get their maintenance taken care of. So we'll mow your lawn, right? But it'll be all electric. We'll also be giving you advice on what to plant next, where to plant it, how to compost and mulch in place, and really kind of help guide you on making those sustainable choices for what you'd pay for a landscaper anyway, you know, if you're a person who has a landscaper.
Yeah, I think that's such a great idea. And like you said, there's so much opportunity there because like, as we saw through COVID, everyone's got these interests that are very adjacent to a lot of the things that we're doing. But since you're covering so many aspects of this, I think it could be very appealing for homeowners to either pick a couple of them that they really enjoy doing, but it also potentially makes landscaping cheaper and easier, much lower maintenance too.
Yeah. So it really does in the long run.
Endless benefits.
It really does in the long run because these, you know, projects, you know, if you can plan it over a 12-month period, it becomes more affordable. You can ultimately do more. And it also, like, I'm really, like, passionate about, like, helping people get outdoors in a way that's not, like, condescending or that just kind of meets them where they're at, right? Like, people have a lot of concerns about the outdoors. And I feel like if you can just give them wins, like early wins, give them something that is fun, something to hang their hat on. I think it starts to create like a daisy chain, you know, where we start to get more interested in the outdoors and their role in stewarding it. You know, like if you're a homeowner, like you have an opportunity to solve climate change, an actual real one. It's right there literally in your backyard or your front yard. And the only thing stopping you is you maybe don't have the resources or the knowledge or the support, like the emotional support that comes with doing something that might be a little odd in your neighborhood, you know? So I'm really kind of there to help them with all of those things, to move the ball forward. You know, ultimately I'm hoping to kind of build a community around it so that I can start to be a little bit self-reinforcing, and not something that people just have to pay for, you know, to get. You know, certainly I want to make money and provide a living for my family, but you know, I'm much more interested in the ideas spreading than I am you know, closed-fistedly protecting.
Sure.
You know,
that's pretty awesome. I could see the the potential for the inspiration to spread too, right? Like you're doing something unique in a lot of places for a lot of people. So I could definitely see other neighbors being interested, you know, and saying, hey, what are you up to here? Why does this look so different than what we're used to? And then again, going back to the potential for the suburbs, you can scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the infrastructure is there. You have the space. It's a canvas for you, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, the big sticky wicket is transportation, right? Like that's the big issue. And I'm so grateful there are lots of amazing organizations already kind of working on that problem. Strong Towns being one that I really, really appreciate mm-hmm. the work that they're doing. But in the end, land stewardship cannot be mandated. It needs to come Absolutely. From the grassroots. I mean, it literally mm-hmm. has to come from the roots. And so I think that I can support those efforts by coaching people up and helping them understand mm-hmm. In a fun and engaging way, like their opportunity and their maybe responsibility to their community and to the earth as a landowner. So yeah, I'm hoping I can bolster those efforts with others that are working on the transportation issue, because if we can get everyone's front yard is a garden and the road mm-hmm. is slow, right? And you're not having to worry about getting, you know, plastered by a 4,000-pound piece of metal, right?
Sure.
Who knows what these spaces could be, you know?
Yeah.
They don't have to be the way they are.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the most interesting things,
mm-hmm.
the potential there. Can you speak to how you're developing green bots or how you're organizing it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really trying to kind of organize it as a community centered thing, which is probably close to gibberish at this point. Like what is community centered landscaping service? What does that even mean? I mean, how I envision it is that an individual who's interested in land stewardship could come to the organization and sort of apprentice with someone who knows what they're doing. And the organization would provide the sort of backbone and marketing and like back end support, mm-hmm. allow individuals to sort of start their own franchises, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't like to think of it that way, because it's more like
mm-hmm.
it's like a plot in a community garden, right? Like they're sort of like, sure. I'm going to work on this land, and it might be the neighborhood that they live in. Ideally, it would be the neighborhood they live in. When they have 20 or 30 customers, whatever an individual can service, which I calculated would be about 20 or 30, comfortably, and it's a mutual thing that I provide that support and the kind of skeleton, the framework for starting that type of business. And then individuals are interested in getting to land stewardship, I would provide that education. And for all of that, it would be like a licensing fee, essentially, to use the software, awesome. And various other things that we'd be producing, mostly the education, the back end community, and the marketing support. So in that way, it's very much like a franchise. But it'd be one less that you have to buy into, and more one that you train your way into.
Right? Sure.
You kind of come, show up and say, I want to learn this work. And if you can do the work, then yeah, let's bring you on and figure out how we can place you in an area that will be successful for you.
Nice. If this project were to like exceed your expectations and you could grow it over the next however long, couple years, in an ideal world, what would that look like for you, like for your community, you think?
Gosh, I'd hate to see what exceeding my expectations are, because I'm notoriously like idealistic and like I see this as being something could be very important. I mean, for one thing, where my expectations are coming from is that I really feel like landscaping is about ready to just like run full tilt into a wall, because mm-hmm. the costs are going up there. The customer service is so terrible, right? And the awareness they're killing the very thing they're being paid to take care of is spreading, right? And mm-hmm. it's like uncontrovertible. It is the fact they are destroying their stewards, right? and they're getting a lot of money for that. And I think that this industry is very close to like just going extinct. And I think they need serious reform. They have to now consider themselves stewards of the land instead of maintainers. They're not janitors of the outdoors, right? They are stewards of the land. And I think it needs that culture shift. So if it doesn't hit that, I think that the landscaping industry, I mean, I think that the way I'm talking about landscaping could be all of it, the whole boat by 2040. And so if you put in that kind of context, the idea that I would be part of this 2% right now of $170 billion industry that could grow from 2% to 100% in a 16, 18 year period, right? Like, I can't even really wrap my head around what that would be like, except for something akin to like personal computers, right? Where it was like this thing that was never going to happen. And then suddenly in 15 years, it was a thing that was everywhere. 15 years later with the internet, it completely transformed the global economy, right?
Yeah.
Everything changed. And of course this is one industry. So that's not going to happen, but it's a gigantic industry. And it's one that is kind of having its Kodak moment. And I don't know if they're going to, switch. I don't know if they're going to be reformed or if they're just going to choose to go out of business. I don't know what option that is. So I think that the sky's the limit for sustainable landscaping as a concept.
Absolutely.
How far, Green Box Homes gets, I don't know. I think I'd probably be very happy with a 20 person business, 20 client business. And I just got to play in other people's yards for the rest of my life. Sounds like a pretty darn great way to spend the rest of my time.
That sounds pretty idyllic though.
Yeah. My hope would be that whole communities take this on. I don't look at it as like, normal landscaping company is like, I want, 100 clients in DeKalb County, right? 100 out of, there's 800,000 residents and something like 150,000 single family homes or something like that, right? I want 100. I want 100. Mm-hmm. Well, my feeling is that I kind of want them all, right? And the more that are involved, the more the community there is, the more that we're changing neighborhoods. I think that, I'm probably delusional, but I think like landscaping presented in such a way that it's part of community building. I think that there might be, it might go from being this like kind of unsexy industry that no one really likes to something that could be, pretty fundamental to life
in
suburban and urban areas.
I can definitely see that. You can see it in adjacent industries as well. I feel like there's that same movement. People are sick of the same old ways. They're sick of service being cheapened to the point that it has been, and same with materials, and the continued move to unsustainable practices in general, like with your turf lawns now, your plastic turf lawns and concrete everywhere. I see it in like the horticulture space as well. People are getting sick of that. Like, why are you trying to plant bananas in Canada in the summer? It's just doesn't make sense. Or they're planting cedars that either die in the summer or get eaten in the winter by the deer. It's pointless, but you're going to spend $20,000 a year to replant your cedars. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. One thing I want to say, Simon, is that we've been talking a lot about Green Box, and that's all great. I do love self-promotion. But I kind of wanted to talk about what you're seeing on what I'm seeing here in the Southern United States and what you're seeing in Quebec, where are the differences there? Because we are countries. And also what you've seen with perma people, you're kind of at that heart of people like reaching out, looking for the information we're talking about, right? What are you seeing there? I know that's kind of a two-part question.
Yeah, sure. It's been interesting seeing everybody's surroundings on Twitter and the sort of environments that they're dealing with. Where I come from and grew up on the West Inland near the coast, it's significantly different to how people treat the landscapes there. It's pretty massively abused. And as you've seen, there's been massive forest fires there. They now have fire season. That's basically summer. Just brutal treatment of the environment there in general. The forests pulling way too much water, complete mismanagement of salmon rivers. And then we moved here to Quebec, and it's been super interesting to see the level of conservation that's built in here. There's a lot more private ownership of land, but there's also pretty crazy regulation on what you can do with that land. Mm-hmm. Even the agricultural. So as of about 1996, they put in some rules that any existing forest needed to have a permit to basically do any sort of management to it. So what this left you with is like certain sections of Quebec are like flat farmland, industrial farmland. But then here in like the Southwest, there's a really interesting landscape. It's basically a patchwork of small fields, still small family farms. But these massive like 100-acre farms are at like 40 and 50% forest cover still. So they're working in at really dynamic conditions, still doing a lot of small scale farming. But I've been reading about this recently, so I found it quite interesting, the comparison. But Quebec is at over 50% of its own food production these days, which is pretty massive. Yeah. And not something you hear about, I think, probably because of the language differences. But I'm not saying it's good, because there's massive, almost authoritarian regulation around what you can do with your forest. Like even getting firewood requires you to get a permit from existing forests. But what you end with is basically a culture of conservation in that way. I don't think it goes down to the suburbs like where we are now. It's the sprawl from the growing smaller cities as people move out of Montreal, for instance, has led to the same issues that I'm discussing before. Like you have a Walmart that basically extended probably 10 years before the rest of the city caught up. And now the city has caught up, but it's just, you know, snakes of streets surrounded by townhomes, very little green space. There's a few parks here and there, but that's really what's had me thinking about the municipal regulation aspect of things. It's like, I wonder if it comes down to developers that are the ones buying up these spots, if it should be on the municipality to say, hey, you need 10% green space, you know, for these, or communal space or whatever.
It's certainly important, right? Because like the only check on that is municipal or county here, right? You know, county regulations. That's the only check, because without that check, developers would do whatever they wanted to the land,
right?
I do find it interesting working with a few home builders in particular that whether they're recognizing it as a competitive advantage or whether they're legitimately interested in sustainability is kind of irrelevant, because you're starting to see a little bit of a sea change on that front. They're starting to realize that like there's actually a profit motive now to sustainability. You know, I read in the Realtor Association of America had their end of year survey or something like in 2022, they had that sophisticated landscaping, meaning like just like an island bed in the middle of your lawn, could have up to 100% ROI for, you know, raising your land prices. Money talks, right? I mean, if the fastest way to change is to make it profitable, and I think that we're starting to see that, cities certainly could push the envelope by just making it unprofitable to do it the other way, right?
Yes.
Because what they do is they just scrape it, right? It's kind of insane. Mm-hmm. So they'll just scrape the earth, all the topsoil, everything is gone. They'll mulch it up, take it to the dump. That's what's happening here in Atlanta. And then they plant trees. It's like the most insane thing, right? Like, and it's all just to save themselves a few bucks and a little bit of time.
Right.
Regulations would help with that, you know, it would at least cause them to have to think a little bit harder. But it's also problematic because the first thing they do is they like, well, developers shout like, oh, well, the cost of housing is going to go up. And that's like the ultimate, like here in America, especially, it's like the ultimate, well, I don't know about that. I don't know if it's or not, but like, it's, that's the never ending like button you can push.
Yeah.
People squeal, right?
It's, yeah, like, it's the same.
Housing prices are going to go up, right? Mm-hmm. Affordable, there won't be any affordable homes anymore. And it's right. Like, there's certainly truth to that. But there are a lot of other pressures, which we don't need to get into right now, like on affecting housing prices beyond just having to not cut down four or five trees on a lot.
Sure. Sure.
But that's what keeps people in place, you know, this constant threat of what's ironically happening anyway, right? Housing prices are still through the roof, right? Like, it doesn't matter, you know, because, again, housing prices are caused by other factors. But yeah, I mean, so tell me about Perma People though. Like what, I mean, when did y'all start that?
So we've been at it 3 years this year, actually. Yeah. This, summer. Yep. Started during the very first, chunk of the pandemic.
Yeah.
It was a
COVID project.
It was a COVID project. Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of your users are, their interest in this is a COVID project too.
Oh, absolutely. Like that's what we saw, especially in the seed marketplace, which is one of the most popular parts of it sort of was, but you could tell a lot of people popped up during that time because their collections grew and mostly based off what they could find at the grocery store and stuff. So I think a lot of these people were pretty fresh, but they were clearly resourceful, which was pretty cool as well. Yeah.
That's awesome. So I know you've explained this before, but tell us a little bit about Perma People, what people can find there, you know, how it's kind of, how does it dovetail with what we're talking about here?
Yeah, for sure. So everything, the backbone of Perma People is a plant database, crowdsourced, just like Wikipedia. Anybody can create an account and become an editor, add their own images, create new plant profiles, etc. But basically what we've done is build as many tools to help people grow food and find plants to grow, all based around the database. So there's a garden planner, so you can pull up the lists that you make of the database, or you can search by certain filters, find plants that grow for you, create your own garden plan or with what you have. And then we have the marketplace as well, so you can actually tie specific plants to your marketplace listings. That's all open as well. And then we have a journal, so you can track your plantings and tie plants in there. And in doing that, you can share like location and timeline data with other gardeners. So say you found somebody in the similar zone to you, you could see when they're planting their tomatoes, or you could see when they're harvesting their melons or whatever. So. The goal is to create a whole ecosystem of open and accessible tools to help as many people grow things as possible. And I believe we're talking about this today as you and I have been jamming on ways we can potentially collaborate with Greenbox. So one thing that Perma People's really looking at doing now is how can we power other projects with the information that we have?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's really incredible, the database you guys have put together, and the tools, you know, because like, as more people do something, there's going to be more need of other types of tools, right? Like what wouldn't have been a market even 5 years ago is now a significant enough market to justify going after and providing tools for.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I'm curious, though, it's a lot of vegetable gardening, right? Or is there a lot of flower gardening, a lot of just like all types of gardening? What are you seeing?
It's actually been a surprising amount of niche things popping up on there as the popular searches. That's really the only data that we track is the popular searches. We don't do any more tracking. But yeah, that's been the most surprising. We thought at first we'd focus on the vegetables. We started with the plants for a future database at some point, and then we just started bolstering it with our own data. We had spreadsheets. We got people to donate their own spreadsheets of their own planting information. Awesome. We normalized those. We uploaded all those. We spent probably dozens of hours, each of the main contributors, just inputting data manually. And then over the years, we've had dozens of other dedicated contributors just come in and create plant profiles or add their own pictures or add planting information to these pieces. And the biggest fans and biggest like users we found are people doing niche projects, which is interesting because they can record their own observations there and sort of add more information that you can't find anywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of makes sense, but that, like, when you think about it, like, you know, post facto, like, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, that kind of makes sense. But that was a surprising finding for y'all.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely focused on building up the popular vegetable profiles as soon as we could, just to make sure that there's some meat there for people.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. It seems like in the different regions of the world too, there's no one database bringing things together. There's either tropical plants that does not focus on food. It's just tropical plants in general, or you have some other databases, which we were based on, but they're tending to be out of date now as far as like Latin and scientific naming goes, since those are probably from books decade or two ago. So like, yeah, there's a lot of interesting opportunity to be networking based on where we are today, I think, with people around the world, which we haven't really seen in a database yet.
Yeah, that's really exciting. So what's next? Like, what is there something you can talk about, like a new feature, a new service, or something that you're planning on rolling out soon?
Yeah, we're actually working on an advanced garden designer at the moment. We're going much more in the CAD direction, based on our own needs. We base most of our decisions on our close crew of community and what we need ourselves. So we dog food all of our tools all the time. But Han said I need a better garden planner, so we started working on that over the fall and summer. Or the spring and summer. And so, yeah, we're super excited to be launching that. You can test it out now, but it's really developing into something quite powerful, I think.
That's awesome. That's really great. Yeah, I'm super pumped about it. Whenever you talk about it, I'm like, yeah, man, this is going to be, I mean, it's game changing, you know, like having the ability to plan things out in such a way. I mean, it's really powerful.
Nice. Yeah, there's a lot of potential for a free tool too, I think, to just get people dabbling and doing their own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I keep kind of coming back to this idea that, like, I think, you know, design is one of the things that is hard to grasp at first, you know, like how to lay things out. But it does help if you have like sort of basic information and you can compile them in such a way. And a planner, like planting plans, is a great way to kind of visualize it from a bird's eye standpoint, because, you know, like you're thinking, like, you know, ultimately you're designing in three dimensions, which makes it difficult, right? But
yes,
at least if you can understand spacing and you can color code things and stuff so that people can kind of see what that elevation would be. Yeah, garden planning is really, it's a really great way to get people to understand some basic design, you know, even if they're not taking a design course.
Right. I'm hoping so.
We're kind of running a little over an hour. I think it'd be a good time to kind of hit the home stretch. What do you think would be a good way to do that? I guess we could talk about the, you know, how we're kind of partnering up. I think there is something kind of unique to it because it is something that it's a partnership that has come explicitly from Doomer Optimism, right? So I think that's kind of interesting, you know, an interesting angle, I guess, a reason to talk about it.
Sure.
But I don't really know what to say exactly about it. So that's the only thing, you know,
yeah.
Like short of people going to, you know, your site and using the garden planner, or going, come to my site and buying a t-shirt. There's not really much call to action on it. So we might, maybe we should just hint at things happening.
We could write it in the notes too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cool. Yeah, I think maybe we should start to take this to the home stretch, you know, and I don't think I'm getting the feeling we have not solved the question of what to do with the suburbs tonight. I think there's a lot of open questions.
Almost.
We can explore that in some other episodes with some people smarter than the two of us. get some extra brain power in here on that. I think the thing that really brings the two of us together and kind of inspired us to try and have this conversation tonight is a sense that, like, sort of land stewardship and growing things is a central, like, part of the formula for solving suburbs. You know, the suburbs, if they're nothing else, they are completely divorced from the resource, you know, nest that enables its existence. You know, it doesn't take care of land well. It
well
doesn't
take
transportation well. You know, it's a divorce from Earth, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I think that reconnecting people where they're at can be the beginning of a response to that that might start reconnecting things.
Yeah, full agree.
Yeah,
full agree.
Have you noticed, gardening at your home, like, how has that had any kind of community effect? Have you been noticing, like, you know, aside from perma people, aside from the projection that we do online, right? Mm-hmm. What's happening locally? Like, what are you seeing, you know, in real life?
So I've used it mostly as an excuse to connect with neighbors, and to like meet people and sort of do goodwill nearby, mm-hmm. as much as possible. Through some connections of perma people, I was a seed hub a few years ago, so I had still these packets of seeds to give away. So we had some people move in around the same time as us, and they put in some gardens, so I was able to go give them a collection of seeds.
Brilliant.
And meet them that way. Mm-hmm. And for fun, I like to grow fruit and nut trees too from seed. So I usually just find local things. And so I was able to meet quite a few people from that this year as well, just from offering them on the marketplaces. And mm-hmm. just as I saw neighbors walking around the hood, just ask, hey, do you want a plum tree? Do you want some strawberries? Like that. So just using it as an excuse, basically. Also, when there's a bounty, of course, sharing it with the more elderly neighbors in the neighborhood was a good way to really connect with them as well. Mm-hmm. Bringing some fresh tomatoes and cucumbers.
Do you make any like value add type of products or anything like jams, pies, things like that?
Not really. We're still pretty early on. This year, it's just our second season, and I've tried to be as frugal as possible, growing everything from seed. So
yeah,
I even started my asparagus from seed. I decided I had the patience. So give it 3 or 4 years. And
I took one from Tom Ruby. I took a tip from him. I spent some time with him in Kentucky and enjoyed his homemade cordials so much that I was like, awesome. I'm going to do this. So I tried my hand at making like I took fennel, like bronze fennel and lemon thyme. And mm-hmm. my thought was that it would be kind of like that. I was going for like a spicy lemon kind of thing, like something, okay. You know, I had no idea if it would work, and it didn't. It didn't work at all. It tasted terrible. But I do see how easy it is now. And now it's just a matter of experimentation. What other kind of things do I have? You know, I think that the issue was that there was not enough of anything. But the I did too much time in comparison with the fennel. So the lemony flavor was a little too forward. It's kind of like squeezing a lemon into a Jägermeister, which is not
okay.
Exactly, I mean, it sounds about as good as you as that sounded. I'll try again though. I mean, but it's like a bottle of vodka, you know, in a mason jar and some stuff from your yard, and it's like, you know, you have something really cool. When I get something
there you
good,
go.
I'll have something very cool I can share with them, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point too. I'm still early and not confident enough to share my herbal beers with anybody, so
yeah, that's awesome. I've noticed the same thing. When I started to kind of what I call garden out loud, you know, out in front of everybody, you know, so everybody can see me making my mistakes, and ideally it would make that okay for other people to make some mistakes in their yards too. I was kind of aware of what I was doing because I'm, you know, on a corner lot at the top of a hill with the only two-story Georgian when everything else is like split or one level ranches with a basement. It's a very like, you have to pass it to get into the neighborhood. Like you cannot miss this house. And so the fact that I more or less am tearing up the only piece of flat grass I have, and putting on all of these pollinators. I mean, I counted them up because I'm having to transplant them because I designed the thing like a complete insane person. I'm now having to redo it. And it's like 55 species of pollinators.
Okay.
I mean, there's so much diversity there. And it's just 1 year. I mean, it's just like year one and I'm getting all of these pollinators, you know, coming. And people are giving me plants. Like people,
oh, that's a good start.
You know, from their houses. I grew a bunch of extra tomato plants, so I just put them out in the yard and was like, "Yo, take them! Like, if you want
nice.
To plant, here you go."
Mm-hmm.
I had a neighbor a neighbor come over tonight and give me plants because she was they were digging up natives out of the local park, and she went
nice.
With me and grabbed some for me, and I just had a bunch of plants sitting there, and it was like, "Pick your pick. What do you want?" Like. You know, I was like, don't touch the oak leaf hydrangea. I need that though.
Yeah.
Anything else, you know? And we had like this impromptu like plant swap, you know? And it is such a cool community. And you don't realize how many people in your neighborhood are part of this community.
Sure.
You just didn't even know it, you know?
Right.
And you know, and now you have something to connect to. And it's kind of nice. Yeah. It's multi-generational too. You know, like,
yeah,
it does give something for the youngest and the oldest to kind of come around,
100%,
which is not very easy to come by in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know,
I feel like it's a little cheesy, but it's always like kind of a hopeful thing too with plants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're planting trees or you're planting native perennials, like you're kind of building towards something. You know, there's always, it's improving every year.
Yeah. That's the crazy thing about landscaping, right? Is that your landscape shouldn't stay the same. It should just get better and better and better every year. And if it's not, like, why are you paying for a landscape, right? Like,
exactly.
I think this is a great thing. You know, a great way of connecting neighbors, you know, it's a start, you know, it's a modest start, of course, but it is a start.
Is there anything else that you would recommend trying or suggest to kind of grow that?
Yeah, I mean, my number one hobby horse with like the gardening influencer industry is that they always start with pots and vegetables, and I think those are both very difficult to do. Like, if you want it to eat something, plant a blueberry bush in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you basically can't screw that up and you're going to get blueberries, you know, especially if you buy like a 3 gallon or a 5 gallon or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
That might actually produce in a season, and you don't have to do anything. Like, it just, it will grow, especially down here, like where they're very native in Georgia. Like, so I always just say start in the ground and start very small. Just pick a perennial and throw it in the ground in a place you think looks good, and then baby the shit out of it.
Yeah,
and you'll get a victory. You'll get flowers. You'll get something to eat. If you start with vegetables, I think vegetables are very easy to give up on because
Yeah.
when, especially when you're busy, because you're like, oh, this isn't worth it because
Yeah.
it's so end focused, right? When planting stuff is about the means, it's about the journey. The end is
Yeah.
completely irrelevant. That is the icing on the cake. And vegetables, everyone's like, I got to get a yield. I got to get a yield. And they never do. You never do your
Yeah.
first season. You screw it up.
Yeah.
And I think that is
Awesome.
demoralizing. And pots are just simply too damn, they're so finicky and they're such a pain
Yeah.
in the ass. Now you
Need
have a,
more
now you
water.
have, yeah, now you have to have a neighbor come water your plant for God's sakes, right? And I think that if you just start in the ground with something that looks good and might produce fruit or flowers, cone flowers, just put a black-eyed
Yeah.
Susan in the ground,
Yeah, there you go.
and so I really recommend, starting that granular and that small and see what kind of let land stewardship kind of will do its magic, on and start to transform things inside of you. One thing I wanted to mention about Greenbox is that coming from kind of the branding marketing world, like I can't help but think about things in those sort of gross capitalistic terms. So I'm trying to turn that impulse to good. So I have a variety of like merch that I'm kind of producing, but I can't like justify selling merch on its own merits. So I'm partnering with nonprofits and organizations that I really like for all of the merch, and one of them happens to be Perma People. Coming up, we're going to be releasing a shirt together, and 50% of the profit will go to Perma People. So look for that. I just wanted to kind of mention that because it is a little doomer optimism, collab coming up here. So just wanted to kind of mention it before we go. If I'm going to shill anything, at least shill some
There you
donations
go.
to Perma People.
Grow the movement.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me, Simon. I think that this is, it's fun to talk to you again, and it's always fun to be on the podcast.
Absolutely. Same to you, Trace. Always a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to what other kind of trouble we can get into in the
Think
future.
we get into plenty of trouble. All right. Have a good night, man.
Good night.